Yeah, there are just so many weird myths out there about the Hebrew alphabet, the Jewish people. We'll refute some of them today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
If there's any way that you can get your computer or cell phone and turn on the live video stream, I'm going to try to illustrate something. I'll paint a word picture for you, but I'm going to try to illustrate something for you that if you can see it, it'll be great. If you can only listen now, you'll be able to watch it later. But we are live streaming on YouTube. Greetings to everyone watching, live streaming on Facebook, audio only. Greetings to everyone listening there, and to everyone all over radio land and listening on all kinds of other devices around America, around the world. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Yeah, I want to dispel some myths, and I want to take a little more time to try to illustrate this myth about Hebrew pictographs having ongoing meaning in biblical interpretation. It is absolute, ridiculous nonsense. I can say that with complete, total authority, without any fear of being rebutted or refuted, and I'll illustrate that for you in a little while. I was prompted to bring this up again when I saw an utterly ridiculous post on our YouTube channel responding to the video that we posted about who are the 144,000 in the book of Revelation, the seventh chapter. And when I told the person what they wrote was utterly linguistic nonsense, they then came back with even more nonsense. Well, if I'd known this or that, complete, utter rubbish. And I urged them to quit while they were ahead, while they were behind, as much as they were quit before they got even further behind. So I want to talk about that and some other myths. Do you know that there were times past in Jewish history that people believed in Christian communities and elsewhere that the reason that Jewish men covered their heads was to cover the horns? Yeah. Uh-huh. Obviously, a little yarmulke doesn't, but if you had a hat of some kind covering it, yeah, to cover the horns. We'll talk about some things, but if you have a question, any Jewish-related, Hebrew-related, Messianic prophecy-related, Israel-related question of any kind, phone lines are open, 866-348-7884. Before we get into any of that, let me start with a sober word here. As we are watching the ongoing charges against Judge Roy Moore, now charges against Senator Al Franken, now bodyguard has come forward, or former Secret Service with Joe Biden, with horror stories from him, alleged, this is all alleged, and again, we don't want to downplay what someone who's been abused or victimized has to say. Some, there is proof. I mean, people have admitted, like Al Franken admitted partially to guilt. Others are just allegations. But we're hearing more and more reports now, more Hollywood stars, and now reports of payments that were made within Congress to settle abuse cases and things like that. What's going to happen when things come to the surface? This is not a time to sit and gloat. If one of your political enemies or adversaries or ideological opponents or someone you don't like takes a fall, don't sit and gloat. Don't be so self-righteous. Good time to examine our own hearts. Good time to examine our own lives. And if you got some skeletons in the closet, get right. Make the thing right. Confess to whom you need to. Set the thing right. And if you're a follower of Jesus, things can be repented of, done rightly, restitution made where it needs to, and things can be under the blood, and you move forward and are a trophy of restoration and redemption. But let's not just sit around and gloat in a self-righteous way. Let's examine our own lives. This is a shaking. This is a serious shaking. Is this part of the larger Trump phenomenon where everything gets shaken? Will your house stand? Will my house stand? Those are the questions to ask. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Yeah, someone asked, what horns? What were Jewish men allegedly covering up? What kind of horns? Devil horns! That's why some people in the past actually thought that Jewish men had horns. And then, because of a misinterpretation of the Hebrew word keren, which can mean horn, but can also refer to a ray or refer to, you know, a sign of glory, horns of light coming from Moses did not mean he had horns coming out of his head as some artists depicted him, but rather these were like rays of light, rays of glory. But this is how myths happen, myths spread. And there's one I hear all the time. Someone said, oh yeah, at a prominent Bible school, a guy uses this, he teaches this. I've got to get to him and tell him it is nonsense. And I'm going to illustrate. I'm going to take a few minutes and illustrate things for you. And I think this will really, really be helpful. But first, let me read this ridiculous comment. It was on our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, where I posted a short video. We're trying to do these in 3 minutes or less now. A short video on who are the 144,000 sealed from the 12 tribes of Israel in Revelation 7, and why is the tribe of Dan missing, which is a mystery, and scholars have different answers. So someone posted this. The tribe of Dan is not there because they are hidden. Dr. Brown would know this. No, I don't know this. D is Dalet, which is a door. And Aleph, A, then Nun, N. So An, A-N, is hidden behind the Dalet door. Wrong. There is no Aleph in the spelling. It is Dalet Nun, D-N. There is no Aleph in the Hebrew spelling. Not only is this ridiculous and completely impossible in terms of understanding the history of the Hebrew language and how the language is used and preserved, as I will show you shortly, that's spelled wrong. It would be like making a major case about the spelling of Michael and explaining what the K stands for. Well, there is no K in the name. So I rebutted this. I mean, it's this whole theory here, and Daniel, El is God, so Daniel is that An is hidden in God behind the door. I mean, this is gibberish. Gibberish with capital letters, gibberish. God says, I am, but Dan is An. He is a man like God, but is not God. It goes, oh, the M and N are similar. The M is a mountain. So God is saying, I am, would be saying, I, meaning me, a strong M, mountain. I am a strong mountain. Nonsense. Daniel is my God is judge, or my God judges. There's no mystery here whatsoever. And we know when the child was born and the name was given to him, Don, that it was tied in with the root for judging and justice. This is nonsense. I might as well tell you that the word nonsense, actually the N stands for noodle and the O stands for Omicron. And the next N stands for Nudnik. So it is noodle, Omicron, Nudnik. And the S stands for Santa and the E stands for eel. And then you have another N that stands for Nancy, my wife, because she's so important. Then you have another S that stands for shout, because I want to shout about how special she is. How does that fit in with Nudnik, Noodle, and Omicron? Oh, I have the secret. It's nonsense. So it's long post. Okay, so I finally went on and said, no insult intended, but this argument is complete linguistic gibberish. Utter nonsense in terms of the Hebrew letters. To start with, Don is spelled without an Aleph. Your argument goes downhill from there, sad to say. So he writes back, or she writes back. Some people don't know how to quit. Some people don't realize this ran into a wall, a dead end. The response, you would be 100% correct if the alphabet came exclusively from Hebrew, which it does not. It came from both Greek and Hebrew. Aleph is Hebrew, but the English is alphabet, which Alpha is Greek. Oh, boy. Here is the deal. The Phoenicians developed the alphabet that was then borrowed by the Hebrews and borrowed by the Greeks, which is why the opening letters of the Hebrew alphabet are Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, and the opening letters of the Greek alphabet are Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and that's why it almost transfers exactly over to English through Latin, etc., A, B, C, D. Oh, now here's where it gets really bad. People, now go back to the Hebrew Bible, and I'm going to illustrate this for you. I'm going to take a few minutes and lay it out. People go back to the Hebrew Bible. They say, well, Aleph was really ox head. B, the Bayit, Beit, those originally that had to do with a house. Dal had to do with a door. And Vav, wow, that was a hook. And they try to come up with meanings using these same 22 symbols to find hidden meanings in each of the words. It is absurd. It is crazy. It is bogus. It is a misuse of the Bible. It is no more accurate and relevant than what I just did with the word nonsense. Okay? The word boy, well, if you really study it, you'll see that the B represents Boris, and the O represents oy, as in Yiddish, oy vey, and the Y represents the New York Yankees, because there is a hidden connection between Boris Yeltsin, Yiddish expression, oy vey, and the New York Yankees, proving that the Jews rule the world. I mean, it would be that idiotic and stupid. You say, Dr. Brown, you're getting worked up over this. For good reason. People are butchering the Bible and making up ridiculous things about the Bible with zero substance for it whatsoever. Enough with the madness. Please. Was that a nice, polite ending? Please. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's get to some of your calls. We'll start with Lou in Greensboro, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you very kindly. I have a question pertaining to Genesis 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is this: the sons of God and the daughters of men, what's your take on that?
Yes, yeah, so in Genesis, the sixth chapter, sir, we've been asked that question a lot, and it's one that keeps coming up. If you'll go to our website, askdrbrown.org, and just type in Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M, Nephilim, that's a key word that's used in Genesis 6. Does it mean fallen ones? Does it mean those who fall on others? Is it just, referring to a race of giants? My best understanding of the text is that it does refer to angels taking on human form, being able to procreate, taking women for themselves, and bearing children that were giants and that were there before the flood, and that would seem to explain, if this happened again after the flood, why you had the Anakim, the Rephaim, these races of giants that the Israelites may have, well, wiped out. You say, could it just refer to the godly line of Seth in contrast with the wicked line of Cain? There's no hint of that in the text. There's no indication that that union would have produced something so ugly that God had to bring judgment. There is no evidence that daughters of men is anything evil or wrong. Sons of God, in contrast with daughters of men. If daughters of men meant a wicked line of Cain, why not refer to them in some wicked way, or daughters of wicked people rather than just daughters of men? So the contrast there really doesn't work. It sounds odd to people that this could have happened, but this seems to be supported by a 2 Peter and Jude, the angels that left their first estate that are punished, the angels that sinned at the time of the flood. This seems to be what it's pointing to. So again, to find out more, go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Type in Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M. Also, while you're there, check out in our digital library, my teaching about the 144,000. See what you think about it. I just lay out my thoughts in brief, so that's all in the digital library, the 144,000, many, many other related subjects. Thank you, sir, for your question. There's always pushback on that, understandably. And people say, well, how could angels procreate? Fair question. Don't only humans procreate? So was it angelic beings taking over human bodies? These are fair questions to ask. But the most basic reading of the text to me, and one that was widely believed in the ancient Jewish world, Book of Enoch, etc., is that these were fallen angels, angels that sinned. All right, we'll come back with your calls in a few minutes. I'm going to graphically illustrate how we got our Hebrew alphabet and even our English alphabet. Stay right there. Change the world.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
That music tells you it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. That is a number to call if you've got Jewish-related questions, if you want to find out about myths that you've heard. Oh, behind everything happening in the world today, it's not just the Illuminati, it's Rothschilds. It's Jewish bankers, and they are underwriting all the evil in the world today. They're people that really, really believe it. And because Jews have had success in banking, and for the small percentage of Jews in the world, we have a lot of influence, ooh, that lends credence to it. Do you know, I've read years past that Jews were responsible for the spread of AIDS, that Jews controlled the Vatican. And some things are so crazy. I mean, how do I refute right now that I am not a Martian, an alien, speaking to you on the airwaves with human powers, and that I've infiltrated the world all these years ago? I mean, how do I refute that to someone who actually believes this kind of nonsense? You know, how do you refute that there are not Jewish spirits from the past running the whole world? It'd be, you know, I mean, people can believe all kinds of craziness. But for those who are thinking, please understand that more lies, more myths are constructed about the Jewish people than any other people. And our great weapon is truth, truth, truth. It may take time, but truth will triumph. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Marcus in Glendale, California. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Just want to say I'm grateful to the Jews for my salvation. Ardent supporter of Israel. Want to make that clear up front.
Well, thank you, sir.
But I do have. And that's why I'm coming to you, because I believe that that you have the truth. So
yeah.
I'm asking about Hosea 1:11. And I'm asking, it looks to me like the first part of that verse is talking about modern Israel. Do you think it is?
Hosea 1:11, I'm familiar with, of course, the whole passage. Just want to make sure I have the right verse. Yeah, the people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. It's debatable. It's debatable. In context, Hosea was speaking about the scattering of northern Israel, about judgment that would come on Judah, and a day of restoration beyond anything that we've seen thus far. That's why some have thought, well, the return of the Jewish people to the land, to modern Israel, it's not really a divine restoration, because it's not glorious enough, it's not spiritual enough. It was started, you know, by atheists and communists and others, and how could it really be a divine regathering? And yet, we have other passages that say that the Jewish people will be returned to the land in unbelief. Preaching in the 1800s, Bishop J.C. Ryle said there will be a restoration of the Jewish people back to the land. And from what he could tell, they would come back to the land in unbelief first before turning to the Messiah. So has this happened yet? Maybe the early stages of it, But in terms of appointing one leader coming up out of the land, great will be the day of Jezreel, it's still something to happen in the future. I would say things are in place for it to happen, but this is not yet happening, what's being described here.
Could I just tell you why I asked that question?
Please, please.
Okay, it's because I recently found out that since 2000, the Knesset elects the president of Israel every 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did some more study and found out that there actually has been a Druze president, for acting president for 2 weeks in the year 2000 that happened. I'm mm-hmm. concerned that at some point in the future, that because of political reasons, the Knesset may elect a non-Jew as their head. And I know that's forbidden in Torah. And Jesus, when he was rejected by the Sanhedrin, mm-hmm. like the official body,
yeah.
he said that he said if another comes in their own name, they will be received. So I'm concerned that a non-Jew of the worst kind may be put in place. I know that's totally hypothetical, but
I understand. And there's some, you know, looking at an Antichrist figure that will rule the world, the Jewish people will embrace as well. So there's all kinds of theories about that. But as far as anything happening in this regard with the president and that role is symbolic, it's hardly the head of the nation in any way. And I don't see someone coming in from outside of Israel being appointed. So I appreciate the concern. I certainly don't see that prophesied there in Hosea 1:11. But thank you. Thank you for raising the question. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Trey in Fort Morgan, Colorado. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, Dr. Brown, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So question for you. I was reading in Numbers chapter 4 the other day and looking just at the numbers of the different branches of the Levites and the duties that they had been appointed to.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of it, so there's roughly 8,500 of them that were to carry out those duties between those ages. And I guess just in my natural reasoning, I was coming to the conclusion it does not seem like there was very much for them to do with that many people. A lot of people standing around with the size of the tabernacle and the different tasks that they have. And I just thought that that was an interesting dynamic, unless I'm missing something. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, take a look at Leviticus chapter 10, all right? Take a look at Leviticus chapter 10 and okay. notice verse 8, the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons are not to drink wine, other fermented drink. Goes on, this is a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. Verse 10, so that you can distinguish between the holy and the common, between the unclean and the clean. And so you can teach the Israelites all the decrees the Lord has given them through Moses. Remember that the Levites, the priests, were involved in teaching the people as well. If you take a look in Deuteronomy chapter 17, it tells us beginning in verse 8, if cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose. Go to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office at that time. So they would also be teaching people. They would also be adjudicating cases. Remember, Moses set leaders over the people for, you know, 50s and hundreds and thousands to settle disputes. So they had a lot of other things to do. And then we know later on, for example, when we get to Luke's gospel, that there were shifts. There were times when they would be doing tabernacle ministry, and there are other things they would be doing in their local communities. So they were full-time in that regard, but were they all active at the tabernacle at the same time? It would seem not. It doesn't mean they weren't doing anything. But it's a great question to ask, though. Most people would read it and not even think about it. So I appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. 866-348-7884. When we come back, I'm going to go right back to the phone, so stay right where you are. And I'm going to get into a full-length explanation of the nonsense of saying the Hebrew letters today have pictographic meanings. They don't. They really don't. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown. I am delighted to be with you. That music told you that it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Did I say delighted to be with you? With you? I'm delighted to be with you. With you. If you've got a Jewish-related question, this is the great day to call in. In a moment, I'm going to do my best to explain to you how pictographs became the alphabet that we use, not just the Hebrew alphabet, but the Greek alphabet and everything based on the Latin alphabet. So many of our languages around the world are European languages, largely based on this same script, which ultimately comes from pictographs. I'll explain that to you in a few minutes. First, your calls, and especially as we're debunking myths about Israel and the Jewish people, let me tell you about one that's still alive and well. It is the blood libel that every year at the time of Passover in particular, that Jews will kidnap. It could be a child. Now it could be a Muslim child. In times past, it would be a Catholic priest or a Catholic child. And that they would torture the person and then drain their blood and use their blood in the making of matzah, unleavened bread. You say, well, of course, nobody would ever believe that. Oh, yes. Jewish communities were tortured, were burned at the stake for these alleged crimes in centuries past. And there is in recent years in Syria, when I was doing research for Our Hands Are Stained with Blood in the early 90s, a best-selling book in Syria had turned that into a novel. And there was a TV series in Egypt that memorialized that. And I continue to see propaganda that comes out from radical Islam and comes out from neo-Nazis or other groups that points in the same direction. People still believe this. I remember hearing about a friend of a friend, I forget, it's many years ago, but the details I remember, that there was someone that had come over from Eastern Europe, a Gentile, Catholic, Orthodox background, whatever it was, had come over to the States, and it was Passover time. And when something came up about matzah, no, it's mixed with blood. They actually believed that because they had heard that. Yeah, and this is somebody in our lifetimes, friend, and there are many, you'd be shocked, who still believe the infamous blood libel. I've researched, I have old books on it, documenting it through the centuries. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to our friend Todd in Seagrove, North Carolina. Welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. My question is coming from chapter 28 of Ezekiel.
Yep.
Lucifer is described as the anointed cherub who covers. And mm-hmm. I understand, I know what the cherub are. I know they're a division of angels. But my question is like, what or who did Lucifer cover as the anointed cherub?
Yeah, it's really not so easy in the Hebrew, to be honest. And as I'm just getting the scripture up there. So, of course, it's an oracle. Ezekiel 28 is an oracle against the king of Tyre. And then behind his pride, an expose of Satan and his fall. That's the best way to understand that. But beginning in verse 11, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, carnelian, chrysolite, emerald, topaz, etc. Your settings, turquoise made of gold. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. That's the way verse 14 is translated, say, in the NIV. If we look at some other translations, let's just see the ISV and see how it's translated there. This says you were a guardian, and this you were the anointed cherub, having been set in place on the holy mountain of God. To say the cherub that covers is only one possible translation of the Hebrew. Certainly no indication whatsoever if that was an accurate translation, what the cherub was covering. Probably not the best translation anyway.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire. All right, I want to take a minute to illustrate for you how we got the alphabet that we have today. Originally, you had things called pictographs. People would draw a picture that represented the sky, represented a person, represented different things. So you would have thousands of signs like this. That's why I say in Chinese, which goes back to pictographs, you have so many signs. Egyptian hieroglyphics, they are those pictures, right? And that's where it starts. So for example, I'll show you something. If you're watching, this would have been in Sumerian. So if you picture trying to make a star just with lines, like one down, then stroke across, then diagonal strokes, this is basically what it would look like. This stood for An or Anu, sky or heaven, but it also stood for the Sumerian word for god, Dingir. All right. So this was a pictograph. When this pictographic script, so again, you have thousands of different pictures that represent different things. Then over a period of time, it can represent a picture or it could represent the sounds behind that picture. So if this represented sky or heaven, it could represent the sounds An or Anu. So you go from pictograph to syllabaries, all right? An alphabet is just letters, consonants, vowels, okay? But a syllabary, each thing represents it, not just, say, the letter B, but the sound B or boo or ba, okay? Or bo, something like that. So when the pictographs from the Sumerians were adapted by the Assyrians and the Babylonians in their language that we call Akkadian, they began to use this cuneiform. It's wedge-shaped. If you ever seen it, it looks like chickens, you know, chicken feet. So they had adopted it so that, for example, initially the star would look like these wedge shapes, just one going horizontally or two, three horizontally and one vertically. And then ultimately, basically one vertical, one horizontal with a little extra wedge on it. But in the Akkadian language, not only would this represent the sounds An or Anu, but it could stand for Dingir, God, or in Akkadian, Ilu, God, all right, which would mean this, that the word following is a reference to a deity, that the word following speaks of a deity. Or it could be the word Ilu, which was God in Akkadian, or Anu, that sound, or it could be ill, or it could be lu, or it could be on, or it could be new. So that's complex. Oh, yeah, of course it is. But just realize when it's your alphabet, you get used to it. In this case, a syllabary, which had over 600 different signs. So when you learn Akkadian, it's a tough language to learn. It was one of the more challenging, probably the most challenging language I learned in grad school. And it has 44,000 different variations depending on when you're looking at the script, but 600 different signs in a syllabary. So pictographs, that's drawing a picture. Okay, this looks like a man. This looks like a woman. This looks like a child. This looks like a goat. This looks like an ox. This looks like a horse. This looks like a star. This looks like the sun. And that's how you would communicate, and then it gets more sophisticated from there. Then you go from that to a syllabary. Instead of just pictures, what sounds do the pictures stand for? Let's simplify it. Instead of thousands, let's get it down to hundreds. And then ultimately, let's make an alphabet that covers all the basic sounds that we make. One letter can stand for a couple of sounds, like we have that in English, right? In the word garage, the word G, you have a hard G, G, and a soft G, J. The word circus, right, in English, you have a soft C, su, and a hard C, k, circus, but you're used to it because you spell it, right? And so in the same way, if I say this versus thank, the same TH, one sounds like the and the other sounds like the, but we're used to it. It's natural for us. So the same way, when the alphabet was originally developed, and it's the one that the Hebrews and the Greeks borrowed, not necessarily every sound was represented by a different letter. sometimes you'd have a couple different sounds represented by the same letter. So, for example, the Phoenicians developed the alphabet that was borrowed by the Hebrews and that was borrowed by the Greeks. So the Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet, looked kind of like, for us now, the letter A on its side with the line through the top going a little bit longer. Now, it's interesting, in modern Hebrew script, and the way it's been written for many centuries, it got separated, so you have what looks like a backward C and then a line straight up next to it. But what does it go back to originally? Well, it goes back to originally an ox head. So here, if you picture the letter A, but make it more like a U, and take that line and make it kind of curvy across the top, there you have the head with the horns coming out. So I just drew something where I put eyes in there to make it a little clearer. Or here's another version of an ox head. Just picture. You know, picture if you look at a longhorn, a Texas longhorn. Picture what that would look like. All right, so let's go back to this for a second. This ox head. Well, again, if you turn it this way, it's our letter A. All right, it's our letter A. So what happened? This alphabet was borrowed by the Hebrews, and it was then also borrowed by the Greeks. That's why the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is Aleph, and the first letter of the Greek alphabet is Alpha, and ultimately we get through Latin and into English, A. And the second letter in Hebrew is Beit, which comes from Bayit for house. And what is it in Greek? Beta. And what is it in English? B. So Bayit, Beit, the second letter, came from something that looked like an enclosure, had to do with a house, an enclosure. And when you look at the original, you can see how it comes to be our letter B. Very easy connection. Okay, so what's the point of it? The point of it is simple. You cannot now reduce thousands and thousands of pictographs into a 22-letter alphabet and say, oh, you just now use 22 pictures to convey meanings. Ox head, house, door, hook. And what does each letter stand for? No. All it is the sounds associated with the picture. So Aleph is an sound. It's a somewhat silent guttural. And Bayit, Beit, house is a B sound. And Dalet, door is a D sound. They no longer mean door or ox head or house. There are people now with this whole, you have to know the Paleo-Hebrew script. You think we don't all know the Paleo-Hebrew script? You think we didn't all learn that when we learned Hebrew, academic studies of Hebrew? When I was getting a bachelor's in Hebrew and a PhD in Near Eastern languages and literature, you think we didn't look at Paleo-Hebrew script and look at ancient inscriptions written in Paleo-Hebrew and like them, the Phoenician inscriptions, the other ancients? Of course we looked at all these things. And this is no secret. But the pictographic meaning was long lost. These are just sounds. And if you want to try to import pictographic meanings, then go back, get online, look at, just search for meaning of Paleo-Hebrew letters. Then take that, say the ox head that comes into English is A, all right? And B, that goes to house, comes in as house, B. And try to make sense of the English language then. Try to put a pictographic meaning on the English language, all right? When we say our ABCs, what we really mean is, well, ox head, house, and try to import that into English, it is idiocy. I don't care how sincere someone is. It is idiocy. And people are doing it with the Hebrew Bible. You could even get the dictionaries where, well, they'll show you each word and break it down for you and line by line. And now, okay, this is ox head. This is a power God. It is dreaming. It is importing meanings that are completely foreign to the text. Say it once more. The pictographs were no longer pictographs. They had not been for centuries. When they were put in alphabetic form, they were just sounds. So they took the main consonantal sounds that they had, found other ways ultimately to represent vowels that developed as well, so that there would be used more and more certain letters to represent vowels. It's that simple. They are just sounds. That's all. They are just sounds. A is A and B is B and Aleph is Aleph and Bet is Bet and Alpha is Alpha and Beta is Beta. There is no hidden meaning in them. I implore you, trash this stuff. Tell all your friends, trash this stuff. It is utter nonsense and a great path for spiritual deception and weirdness. All right, we come back. We're going straight to your calls. So stay right there. Got a bunch of folks on hold. We'll get you on the other side of the break.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Make me glad by your deeds, O Lord, so I sing for joy at all your hands.
Welcome to the Line of Fire. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Thanks for joining us. Hey, I just want to alert you to something. Everyone listening on radio, listening on our Facebook audio feed, I was actually holding up some pictures. We may do this with formal illustrations at another time, put out a separate video. But I just drew out some things with markers before. I was holding them up and showing. Everyone watching on YouTube could see that. You say, well, I can't watch on YouTube right now. Great. We'll post the whole show a little later today. It's on our YouTube channel. So that's Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on YouTube. And we're doing this through your help. If you go to our GoFundMe page, so that is GoFundMe.com/AskDrBrownStudio. Ask Dr. Brown Studio. GoFundMe.com/AskDrBrownStudio. You'll find out what we're doing, and your gifts are helping us do so much more to convey everything we can in the clearest possible terms. So thank you for your partnership. On Facebook, Samuel asked, can I address the Black Hebrew Israelite movement? We've done several whole shows devoted to that with a special guest, in fact, that has been a great help and blessing to us. So if you'll just go to AskDrBrown.org and type in Hebrew Israelite or Black Hebrew, you'll find whole shows we've done on that, and we plan to do more. Raphael on YouTube, thanks for appreciating the channel. We are going for it. Peyton and Raleigh, I'm just going to answer your question quickly. The book of Jasher or Yasher, should it be in the Bible? We don't have it. We don't have it. There is a book that was written many centuries after the Bible, claiming to be the book of Yasher, but we don't have the original. If God wanted us to have it, we would have had it. It's quoted, it's referenced, but other books, ancient books, are quoted and referenced, and we don't have them. It was not God's purpose for us to have them. If they're ever discovered somewhere, fine, but the so-called book of Jasher, you'll see online, say that's not the original. That was something written many centuries later. And Jerichiah, name of God, proper transliteration, Yahweh, or Jehovah, or Jesus, Yeshua. If you go to AskDrBrown.org, you will find full explanations of the right transcription and the right transliteration and pronunciation of those names, all at AskDrBrown.org. Let's go over to United Kingdom. James, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. James calling from the UK once again.
Yes, sir. I remember chatting
about,
with you.
I just had a question about understanding the, you know, how Christians should view Israel and the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians. Asking as a Christian who honestly doesn't really know what to think of the Israeli-Palestinian situation, you know, got some very, very mixed feelings. Do you think it's possible to consistently love and care for and support the Israeli people without necessarily supporting the institution of the State of Israel?
You could love Israelis, but you're going to be undercutting them at every turn by not recognizing the legitimacy of the state. And it's going to be very hard to understand why they take the security measures they do, why the homeland is so important to them, if you don't recognize the legitimacy of the state. Yeah, you can still love Israeli people, I would suggest to you a better path is to recognize that God has restored the Jewish people back to the land, that it is of critical importance to God, and to the world, and to the Jewish people that it's happened, but that you can be for Israelis and for Palestinians and for justice at the same time. I have friends of mine in Israel that work closely with Arab believers that support justice for Palestinians and that are 100% standing with Israel. So here's why I believe it's so important, James. Number one, scripturally, the only way the Jewish people could be back in the land today, 6 million strong, as if God regathered them. Because when God blesses, no one can curse. When he curses, no one can bless. When he smites, no one can heal. When he heals, no one can smite. When he opens the door, no one can shut it. When he shuts the door, no one can open it. And when he scatters, no one can regather. The only way that we've been regathered, having been scattered in God's wrath, is not by our power or by the will of man, but by the will of God. We also have very clear prophetic scripture, say Zechariah 12 and Zechariah 14, among other passages, that Jesus will return to a Jewish Jerusalem, and that Jewish Jerusalem will be attacked by the nations of the world. That can only happen if the Jewish people are back in the land and have sovereign control over Jerusalem. Not only so, but only the Jewish people have been longing through the centuries to be back in the land. Others who lived there never made it their official homeland or state. There was no such thing as Palestinian, really, before the Six-Day War. And after that, in 1967, those that identified before as Jordanians now identified as Palestinians. Before that, if you spoke of the Palestinian people, you were talking about Jews, because they were the ones living in Palestine that said, this is our homeland. When a Muslim prays, say, living in Israel, a Muslim could have their back to Jerusalem because they're facing Mecca. Jews around the world are praying towards Jerusalem. And you have the physical nation of Israel is about 1/650th of all the surrounding Arab and Muslim land. So you're talking about one sliver of land for Jewish people almost wiped out by the Holocaust. And this is in keeping with prophetic scripture. I say plainly, it's God who brought the Jewish people back. It's the devil who wants to destroy them. Therefore, it's imperative that we recognize that and stand with them, also understanding the horrible history of oppression, and also understanding that Jewish people would love to live in harmony with their Palestinian neighbors. They don't want to be at constant war. They don't enjoy sending all their kids, male and female, into the army for 3 years for men and 2 years for women. They don't enjoy having to spend so much on security and having to, you know, you go into a mall and you have to go through metal detectors. They don't enjoy that, but they have to do it because they're radical Muslims and others who want to destroy them. The dictum remains true that if the Palestinians put down their weapons, there'd be no more war. If the Israelis put down their weapons, there'd be no more Israel. So we stand with Israel for many reasons, but if Israel is mistreating its Palestinian neighbors, if Israel is not doing what is right and fair for its Palestinian neighbors, then we call Israel to account because we want justice for all. And if the surrounding Arab nations had absorbed the Palestinian refugees the way Israel absorbed Jewish refugees, you would have had no problem whatsoever. But this was a specific plan. In the 1950s, the Arab League specifically said, we will not bring in any of the refugees. Why? This must be a lasting blight and a lasting indictment against Israel. That's why you even have in the Palestinian territories and in countries like Syria and Lebanon, you still have Palestinian refugee camps among their fellow Arabs because they're just not letting them settle. So this is the reality to this moment. There's a great book, too, by David Brog. Let me just get the title for you, if I can call it up. David Brog, and it's one of the newer ones that addresses this, B-R-O-G, Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace. David's a Jewish person, not a follower of Jesus. I think you'll find it helpful. David Brog, Reclaiming Israel's History, Roots, Rights, and the Struggle for Peace. Hey, I'm out of here. But back with you, taking your questions tomorrow.